Welcome to David Clark's We Are Superman podcast, episode number 289. I am your host, Bill Stahl. If you've ever run an ultramarathon, you almost certainly know the name of Marshall Ulrich. His accomplishments are unparalleled, and if I tried to list them, I'd undoubtedly leave out many. I could naturally mention his 29 official bad water finishes in Death Valley, a race most of us would not even tackle once. Or that he dwarfed those finishes by continuing on to the Mount Whitney summit, or that he once ran the entire 425-mile perimeter of Death Valley, which we have fun talking about here. He completed the seven summits on his first attempt. That's the highest peak on all seven continents. He set the speed record for the transcontinental run across the United States, recounted in his great book, Running on Empty. I could add his Stray Dogs team completed in all of the Echo Challenges, televised as the world's toughest race. You may have heard about all of this, so instead let's focus on his latest endeavors, like the Route 66 Ultra Run, a 140-mile multi-day event along that historic route in Arizona, and his support for his good friend and fellow Stray Dogs teammate Mark Macy in his inspiring battle against Alzheimer's. Marshall was one of the nicest people you'll ever meet in the sport. He was an early mentor to an aspiring ultra-endurance athlete named David Clark, and wrote the foreword to David's first book, Out There, A Story of Ultra Recovery. Marshall's latest book, Both Feet on the Ground, will inspire you to seek out your own adventures. Grab on tight, you're in for a thrilling ride listening to Marshall. But first, if your running motivation is also flagging in this rough winter weather for many of us in the U.S., UESCA certified coach Mickey McConaughey and I have begun the Be Positive Runners community. Mickey and I will provide you customized personal workouts on the Training Peaks app, and we will have group online calls where we can share experiences, tips, and provide encouragement to one another. Hopefully this will develop into group trips to goal races. We will initially limit the community to 10 motivated individuals who want to help themselves and others knock out their 2024 goals. If interested, shoot me a message at silly_billy@msn.com or on Facebook or Instagram messengers, and we can talk to see if you would like to be a Be Positive runner to achieve more in 2024, or mention it to a friend who you think could use this kind of positive community. Okay, now here is Marshall Ulrich and me. Hey, Marsh, welcome to The Hive here, David Clark's podcast. And as I mentioned off air there, I was just, we didn't plan it this way, but we're recording this on David Clark's birthday, which is just absolutely amazing.
It is amazing. And it's my wife's birthday too. So it's a very special day.
Oh, no way. Well, happy birthday to Heather. That's great.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right. What do you guys have planned?
Well, we don't have too much planned. We're down here in Lake Havasu City, and, you know, we always go out here. This is, you know, it's beautiful weather here, so we're able to get out, and they've got a little walking loop and a jogging loop that's out on the island, and it's nice to get out there, and, you know, it's just beautiful weather, so a little bit different from Colorado, where our home is.
Yeah, you know, this is actually one of two podcast recordings I'm doing from Arizona this week, and I'm like, what am I missing here? I'm sitting here with these piles of snow out here, and you know, so it is nice down there, huh?
Yeah, it's perfect. We're getting you know, some of that weather from California that's drifting in here, so it's overcast, which is very, very strange, at least the last 6-7 days, so it's really out of the ordinary.
Yeah,
but it's nice.
You think it's nice? Okay, I just got back from New Jersey. Didn't see the sun for 4 days there, and people told me they hadn't seen the sun in 3 weeks, and that's why I left the East Coast. You know, we have a brilliant Colorado sunshine going here today, which is great. So, well, enjoy your clouds, I guess. So, but yeah, last time we actually talked at length probably was David's memorial. So it is kind of interesting how this is full circle. I did not plan it this way. So we're recording this on February 5th, even though this won't come out till next week. But still, pretty amazing how our paths crossed, you know, through David. And I know it's crossed before as well. But what a remarkable man.
Yeah, it was. And I can remember him coming to Idaho Springs, and he had gotten a hold of me, and he hadn't even run an ultra run, at least a 100-miler. He'd run shorter distances. So, you know, he sat down and he was just kind of picking my brain as far as, you know, what to do. And he was particularly interested in Badwater and Leadville, of course. And, you know, it's always fun to kind of share experiences. And, you know, I could tell he was just so incredibly motivated to just get going with life and really put it in, you know, hyperdrive. And that's exactly what he did from that point on. I mean, I was amazed at how much he did.
Right.
Right.
No, and so we got some feedback going there. That's kind of weird. But in any case, yeah, I don't know if he was making up for lost time or just maybe he just seen the light. And, you know, he, you know, if he'd seen, he started when he was 20 years old, he would have gone at it with just as much zeal or maybe, you know, a lot of those life lessons that he learned from having been an alcoholic, an addict, obese, all that, you know, whether he needed all that to really get it all to kick in, you know?
Right, right.
Yeah. You know, I know you and I have both seen, you know, even though we both started in the ultra world, you know, a long time ago, how the recovery world has really become such a huge component of the ultra world these days. People who have experienced addiction and alcoholism who have taken to ultra running instead. I find that just a fascinating change.
Yeah, and it's, you know, you could argue that it's just another addiction, but at least it's a good one.
Yes.
In my view, anyhow. So, you know, what better way to kick off another chapter in your life, so to speak?
Yeah. Now, you know, that's a beautiful way to put it. It is a new chapter, and they're doing – I've always said, yes, it is more positive addiction, if you want to call it that. But, you know, they're learning something, you know, about the beauty we've always known about ultra running. You know, to me, a lot of it was getting out in nature. I mean, you know, honestly, when I first ran Leadville, and that was back in 92, and, you know, I'd run the Pikes Peak Marathon back in the 80s and things like that, but I never really gave it any thought about why I was doing it. I really didn't. I mean, maybe deep down, I was trying to challenge myself, but I never gave it any thought. To me, it was just like, huh, looks like an interesting thing to do. I think I'll go do that, you know? You know, really wasn't until many years later I started thinking about, oh yeah, well, why do we do things like this?
Yeah, and it was, you know, as you were saying, I was much the same. I just kind of jumped into it. I've been, you know, running since, I guess, 1978 or so, and then got into ultras mostly about 1986. I think I ran my first 50-miler up in Cheyenne. That was Brent Winger's, you know, 50-miler, Laramie to Cheyenne.
Yeah, yeah.
That was the first one that I did. But, you know, it just kind of took off from there. And I didn't, it was more of a curiosity, but I went out there and started running. And I just thought, well, you know, I want more. I want to do some longer distances. And it was a way of testing myself. But one thing that, you know, I can tell you is, I don't know if it's, you know, I'm not saying it's any better, but there wasn't all the social media stuff. And here I am doing a podcast with you.
Right.
There wasn't all the social media. So I always think we were, you know, I pride myself in saying, yeah, we were doing it for all the right reasons. Well, you know, that's rather presumptuous. But I think that really is,
right.
You know,
right.
It was for me anyhow. There wasn't any fanfare or anything that was associated with it. And I'd usually take a weekend off or something like that and go do Leadville. And then I'd go back to work. And sometimes people at work didn't even know I was gone for the most part because I was
right.
You know, just not there.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah. You know, I've told people before, don't go up to watch the Leadville 100 because you'll probably decide to do it next year. And that's exactly what happened to me. I mean, you know, I was very happy running marathons, and like I said, I'd run Pikes Peak, which, you know, obviously is a little more than a marathon effort, but, you know, I was happy doing that, and somebody said, hey, there's this race called the Leadville 100. I know this guy running. You want to come up and watch this? That was in 91, and I went up there, and it's, little did I know I'd be signing up to do it the next year, but my thinking then was I was coaching basketball at a Catholic high school, Holy Family, and the scoreboard broke in the middle of a game. And, you know, it was an old scoreboard and an old school and an old gym. Sure. And I said, hey, what a great idea. I'm going to do a fundraiser. I'm going to raise the $5,000 we need I'm going to run the Leadville 100. That was my only thinking then. And we did all these crazy stunts. Like I'd be wearing my suit coaching. And then at halftime, I would run laps around the court and have, you know, Catholics are great about betting. You know, they play bingo and everything else. So they would place bets on how many laps I could run around the gym floor during halftime in my suit. And so, it just raised all this money, and that was my whole thing. Is I was just going to go raise $5,000, and we did. We raised $5,000, got new scoreboards, and but I didn't finish that year. My problem was I there was nothing written out there about how do you train for something like that. I didn't know. Pretty well trained. My problem was I would actually get to the aid stations, and I had all these Holy Family supporters up there, and I would just sit there chit chatting with them because I was so happy to see everybody. And I got cut off at Twin Lakes inbound. In fact, there were pictures of me shooting hoops. I got this message saying they're going to end our meeting here. Huh. That's really weird. You know what? I'm going to buy a subscription here to Zoom right as we're talking here. So bear with me. I don't know what's going on here with that. That's weird. I already had a subscription here, but I'm just a quick whatever it takes here. So, but whatever.
I think it might be okay on my end. I think I have an extended like subscription on this computer.
I can't see right now while I'm sitting here screwing around with this, but I'm just going to keep talking here. This is weird. Anyhow, there were pictures of me shooting hoops in the fire station there at Twin Lakes because I felt so good. You know, and I just, I'm sitting there screwing around. I don't know. Now it's not even letting me do this. So what the hell? I learned my lesson. I came back 2 years later and finished in 94. So, I really didn't have any kind of thing like, oh yeah, I'm trying to challenge myself or any deeper reason to why I was doing this. So,
right.
Yeah. But hey, you know, one thing, you know, my intention though was actually to kind of work backwards here a little bit. And so, you know, you've got your Route 66 up there behind you. And, you know, I think a lot of people know a lot of your story from earlier on, but, you know, wanted to talk about what you're doing more recently here, which is, you know, this Route 66 race that you've got here, which just looks really fascinating to me. I mean, I love the way you talk about how it's a race for everyone and, you know, honoring the tribe down there. And I can't pronounce it, but you probably can. So, tell us more about what you got going on there with that.
Yeah. So, my wife and I, you know, we've been doing a lot of fundraising over the years, just as you have. So one of the fundraisers that we did, after I did the winter, Badwater, you know, so that was the first thing the year before. And then the second thing was this. And, I told Heather, I said, let's go, you know, do Route 66 and just walk it together. And it just so happens that just northeast of here in Seligman is kind of what they call the historically where Route 66 was reinvented. If you've ever seen that goofy cartoon Cars or something, that's the story of Route 66 where, you know, Highway 40, the interstate, bypassed, you know, Route 66, that portion of it. In fact, it was even taken off the maps. So we set out to find the longest portion that we could do because we were up for 100 miles or more. And sure enough, right here in Arizona, starting in Seligman, going to Topox 66, it's 140 miles. And the fantastic thing about it is it's just steeped in history. 97 years ago, they ran the Bunyan Derbies on this exact course. It still remains the same. This is the longest portion of Route 66 that exists in the United States by far. So we decided, I told Heather, I said, why hasn't anybody done like a, you know, it's like a Badwater style thing where you get a crew and you come out and do the 140 miles. So it's very similar to Badwater, and I'm sure, you know, a lot of your listeners are familiar with it. So, you know, you too can come out and do that 140-mile stretch from Seligman to Topak 66. And interestingly enough, the person that we have start the race is, they call him Angel, that's his first name, Delgadillo. And he is now, he'll be 97 years old, and he starts our race. And he had a barber shop, and he was the one that was behind the whole historic Route 66, getting it designated as, you know, historic, and it would be preserved. And he did this, I think it was back in 1986 or something. So, you know, he's the guy who's responsible, and so it was a big deal. So, yeah, we have this every year. There's, you know, the solo division, and last year we opened it up to relay teams, too. You can do anywhere from, okay.
Yeah.
You can have anywhere from 3 to 5 people and split it up any way that you want. You can either run a mile, you can run 30 miles, and the next person jumps in. So, and you're absolutely right. We call it a race for everyone. We have no real qualifications for it. In fact, last year we had one fellow who came out. He finished the race, I think it was in about 42 or 43 hours. And there's a 60-hour, you know, cutoff on it. So it's very, very liberal. He had never run a running race in his life. Of any distance, and he finished the race.
No way.
It was unbelievable.
Wow.
So, you know, it's just a lot of fun. Everybody has a lot of good times, and there's all these quaint little places that have been, you know, re-renovated and preserved so they look like, you know, it's a blast from the 1950s. Plus you have, you know, movies that had taken place out here that were shot, like Universal Soldier and Cars, and The Grapes of Wrath was written about, you know, the Okies passing on this very route that we run the race on. So, extraordinary, and it's steeped in history.
Wow. Okay. I didn't realize about Grapes of Wrath. That's pretty interesting. But yeah, I mean, I've been through your website for the race and seeing, you know, like the giant tiki that's out there and some of the, nostalgic, I guess, is the way. I mean, the only thing they don't have is, like, you know, 1950s Cadillacs, you know, like Car Henge, you know, in Nebraska. That's about the only thing they don't have out there. But I mean, it is a great piece of Americana that you guys are doing a great job of honoring. I noticed, you had a guy who finished the race in just over 30 hours this year, and then you had I think your third place finisher was 70 years old, James something. I can't pronounce his last name, but it's like, holy mackerel, that's great.
So, you know, it's, and what we also do is, take, for instance, if you're over 70, forever, you'd like this, Bill, or I like it anyhow.
Yeah, let's not push it.
For every year that you're over 70 years old, you get an extra hour.
Oh, really?
So it truly is for everyone.
Yeah, man, you could be out there a long time if you get some 100-year-old out there, though.
Well, hey, I'd welcome that. I mean, it'd be a treat to have somebody out here.
Oh, yeah.
We had a couple of 80-year-olds. There's one that was going to come out last year, and something happened where he couldn't make it. But I was very much looking forward to that.
Right. Oh, well, how cool.
Age shouldn't be so limiting except for, you know, injuries and stuff like that, right? We just had a conversation about that. But,
I had joked with Ken Klober about, like, well, you need to have, like, age-graded cutoffs at the Leadville 100. Sure. And he's like, there's no way in hell we're going to do that, you know?
Right.
So, even at my age, I'm going to be out there pushing it, trying to still hit those damn same cutoffs as before. But, that's awesome what you got going on down there. And then you particularly do honor the Hua 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 tribe. I'm sorry, I can't pronounce it, but how do you say that?
Hapapai.
Hapapai. Well, that's easier than I made it, right?
Yeah. And we pass right, you know, through their reservation. So, you know, and they fully embrace it. They're, you know, everybody along the route, they interestingly enough, there is quite a bit of tourism that is out there, and not that many Americans go. Over half of them are from Europe, of the tourists that come out there and visit Route 66 because it has such a reputation.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, why do you think that is?
A lot of them from Germany.
Yeah.
A lot of Germany's from France, you know, all over the place. But, yeah, it's very interesting. There's an equal portion of people from Europe than from the U.S.
Yeah.
And Japanese.
Yeah, something somebody told me is really interesting is that when you see those Cruise America campers,
yeah,
those are Germans. For whatever reason, they I don't know, like somehow they rent those. There must be a Cruise America representative in Germany or something. I don't know. So just notice that if you ever see those crews in Route 66.
I'm very familiar with them. Every time that Heather and I see one, we laugh because that's what we used when I ran across America.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we've okay. rented one of those. So
all right. Well, you know, I guess your last name sounds pretty German.
Yeah, that's right. It is.
Oh, that's great. Well, and one of the major components to the race, of course, is your fundraising effort.
Yeah, so we raise money for the historic Route 66 as well as Alzheimer's.
Right.
And, you know, we've been doing that for some time. And, you know, Heather, kind of my wife, she kind of heads all of that up. And, you know, I think as of 2 or 3 years ago for various organizations, I think we, you know, we're well over $1 million now of just raising money over the last 30 years, say, for one various organization or another. And now of course, it's for Alzheimer's because my, you know, dear friend Mark Macy, who you know,
of course,
was diagnosed with early onset. And, you know, he's doing okay, but, you know, he's slipping. You were losing Mark, you know, just a little bit at a time, but Mark is still Mark. He's still there. And, you know, his personality is exactly the same. If you see him on the trail or if you see somebody on the trail, the first thing he asks is, you know, how are you doing? And he wants to know all about you. It's not about him at all. So, you know, that shows the quality of character.
Yeah, no. Yeah. And we'll talk a lot more about Mace, of course. I mean, his character just shines through his battle with, I mean, he was in his mid 60s, I guess, when he was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. Yeah. And, when you hear Mark speak, you know, or Mace, when I saw Mace last, I guess it was probably at that book event they had at, BP Run Company. And you're convinced when you hear Mace talk that he is going to beat this. I mean, know, it's, you know, sometimes you sit and think, oh, yeah, sure, whatever. But, you know, with Mace, you really do believe it that, you know, he's not like me saying I'm going to win the Indy 500 this year, which you'd look at me and say I'm nuts. But with Mace, you're like, yeah, he's going to do it.
Yeah. And that's, that type of attitude, you know, if you fully understand the person. And, you know, I think that there's a little bit of that type of attitude in all of us. And, you know, we want to expand upon that to just embrace it to the point that that's what we're all about.
Yes. Yeah. So your history with Mace, well, let's touch on that a little bit. I mean, you guys spent all the time in the Echo Challenges, and obviously you guys were neighbors or are neighbors in Evergreen. And, you know, you guys have pretty tight bond there from a lot of common racing adventures. And I know you guys were drawn to each other really by the force of your personalities, I think, right?
Yeah, I think that's really true. You know, way back in, you know, 1990, I knew about Mark and he knew about me, and we used to run together, and he'd be out at Leadville running, and as well as myself. And then in 1995, they started the Eco Challenges, and I had the privilege of racing with him in 8 of those. There were 10 altogether, including the most recent one, which was in 2019. And so, you know, I got to know him, and, you know, the big joke was, is we knew more about each other than our wives knew about us. So, yeah. And it was just, one of those things where it just kind of clicked, because take, for instance, when we get lost or something, we didn't care. We just love being out there.
Right,
right. Laugh it off and stuff as much as we could. Sometimes we'd be a little bit pissed off about it, but
right.
It was just, there was just a camaraderie there. And then, you know, of course, there was another two people that, in fact, we just had a reunion here at this last Route 66. There's Lisa Smith Batchen was at that same one, and Dr. Bob Ha.
Yeah.
And so we got together, and that's how we dubbed ourselves Team Stray Dogs. And, you know, we've been racing together on and off for all this time. So, you know, it's a pretty special bond between the four of us. And I think it just, we all have our quirky idiosyncrasies and our personalities, but we all sort of make up for what the other one lacks, if you will. And so I think that's what makes it special for us.
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me of the old expression you use in like golf tournaments, where you're paired together with somebody and you ham and egg it. You know, like one guy's a good driver, another guy's a good putter, and you know, you right. put it all together and you've got yourself a good score. And I think you guys complemented each other so well. You ham and egged it to some pretty epic finishes there.
Yeah, we had some good finishes. Like, you know, the highest we had was second, but we'd you know, we probably three or four times finished in the top 10. And you know, there was something to be said for that, because there were some of those races where there would only be maybe 10 or 20% that would finish. So I think the average was maybe about 40, 50%. And we were fortunate to participate in all of them. And I think there were three of them that we didn't finish out of the 10. The most recent, of course, was this one in 2019, but before that, you know, and that's not too bad of an average for, you know, that type of a sport.
No, not at all. No, I mean, it's not too bad even for most ultra marathons, right?
Yeah.
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 It's in the theme of working backwards, the last one that you guys did, where they kind of rebooted the Echo Challenges, the what do they call it? The World's Toughest Race, or I forget what the title was. Yeah, it was on Amazon Prime, I think. Bear Grylls hosted it, and it was really fascinating watching you guys pushing each other through, having all that experience behind you, but having, you know, the ravages of age, so to speak, like caught up to all you guys. And but still, I mean, what struck me the most was the love. You know, you wanted to see Mace get through, and Mace never wanted to be the type who said, like, yeah, hey, I'm just this boat anchor out here holding everybody back. He wanted to obviously pitch in whatever he could as well, too. And so that's what I thought was so heartwarming about watching that whole adventure, watching you guys struggle through the rain and the mud and, you know, the open ocean adventures, whatever. It was very cool.
Yeah. So you're absolutely right. It was a reboot from, I guess it was 2002, where we were actually in Fiji at that time. So that was the last race that we did. And of course, Mark Burnett, you know, he's got Survivor there, so that's a good stage for him.
Yeah.
So, of course, he brought it back to Fiji once again. But I can remember after we finished 2002, Mark and I and, you know, Mikey Closure and some of the other people like Rebecca Rush, who, you know, became an excellent, you know, mountain biker and won Leadville two or three times. You know, we just, you know, loved what we were doing, and we were hard pressed to go back, but we did it anyhow.
Yeah, right. Well, that's great. You know, what was, I mean, was it just a matter of, hey, we're trying to reclaim our youth, or, you know, what were you thinking in 2019 when you guys went back to that? What was it just a matter of, like, hey, proving, hey, old guys can still do it? I mean, what was the ground thinking to getting back into it?
Well, we kept bugging Mark Burnett, you know, when are you going to bring back the Eco Challenge? When are you going to, you better hurry up, because, you know, even the one in, 2002 in Fiji, we were the oldest team there, the average age. And so, you know, here we are, what was it, 17 years later?
And, right.
We aged. We were, you know, I was 68. Mark was, I think, 64. So we were all, you know, you know, our middle 60s or something like that. And I think a part of it was just wanting so desperately to kind of get back together and regain some of that youth, but also to show other people that, you know, no matter what the age is, you know, you can go out and do it and you can persevere. And in some ways, mentally, you're even stronger, although physically, you're not as strong. So, you know, it was just a lot of fun. And we remembered Fiji just perfectly because it was all mud. It was all sort of, you know, sloshing through jungles and stuff like that. So we got out there and we started thinking to ourselves, yeah, you know, now I know why I didn't want to come back here. But anyhow, right. It's an extraordinary place. And I will say this about Fiji, of all the places that we raced around the world, the people there are the most friendly in the world. And that's what makes it really special.
Yeah. You know, I would totally believe that. And, you know, I just got back from spending 3.5 weeks in Asia, and I'm amazed. People everywhere there are so nice and so polite. I mean, we were in Bali, and I mean, oh my God, you just can't get over how nice they are to you. Or in Japan, where literally we're a bunch of dirtbag travelers with backpacks,
right.
And we're checking into a hotel, and as the doors are closing, they're actually bowing to us as the doors go, and we're like, who the hell are we? You know, everybody over there is just so amazing. I wish Americans could be more like that.
Yeah, it's humbling because, you know, they're very personable. They want to know more, just like mates. They want to know more about you. They you know, love hearing about the culture, and they're so terribly respectful. And, you know, I think we've lost a little bit of that in the United States. And, you know, so we have had the advantage, you and I, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners, where we're able to go out and travel. And I think that sort of broadens your horizon. But more than anything, I think those people have a lot of gratitude for what they have, even though it's sometimes very, very meager. And they're so willing to share what they do have, even though it is, you know, much less than what we do. So, you know, there's really some very poignant lessons to be learned there from them.
Yeah, I think with age comes that gratitude of being able to share what we have, how limited it is. And, you know, I think we're both at the age, I think we like to evangelize a little bit about staying in good health and, you know, and that we can still do things, right? I mean, it's
sure.
And I think that's sharing a lot of our experience, but also our perspectives. And do you feel a little bit more like an evangelist about, you know, what older folks can do? I mean, you know, I've seen some more research about, like, you know, all these things saying, oh, you see these articles say, well, people over this age shouldn't be heavy lifting or shouldn't be doing this or that. And I always look at that like, that's crap. You know, it's like, I mean, if you want to be able to pick up your grandchild or pick up that bag of kitty litter you need or whatever, you got to stay in shape, you know, but anything, if you want to go out and go take a hike or whatever, you got to lead a healthier lifestyle. So I feel a little bit like I'm turning into that evangelist in a way. I mean, do you? I mean, I know that was a little bit of the subject of your last book too, but do you feel like that's a little bit more of your mission as you've gotten older?
Yeah. You know, you do have to be very careful about that because you don't want to act like you're preaching, but I think we do gain. I think all of us, you know, across the board, we gain more knowledge. And, you know, if we can somehow convey that to other people, I can remember there were older people that were talking to me about things and it sort of resonated with me. And now it's like I think to myself, oh, I know what they're saying now. I know what they were saying, you know, then, you know, just take your time, maybe going a little bit slower, observing, you know, what's going on. Now I get what they're saying. And I think the most extraordinary thing about a lot of older people is that they don't complain, even though you know you see this old guy walking across the parking lot, take for instance, and it's almost painful to watch him walk across. And then you stop and talk to him, and all of a sudden, you know, he or she, their faces light up and they're just you know, these wonderful people and stuff, even though they're dealing with this pain that is probably at times unbearable.
Yeah, good so point.
There's lessons to be learned from all of that. And, you know, I think we just need to pay a little bit more attention to that when we're younger. It's hard, though.
Yeah, no, you said you heard older people talking and you it resonated with you. I was thinking you were going to say, yeah, I listened to it and it went in one ear and out the other one, because that's the way it feels sometimes, right?
Yeah.
You know, a couple of years ago, I got to meet Stan Cottrell. I never knew how to pronounce it.
Sure.
I mean, here's a guy who, he'd run across the country when he was much younger, but he was doing it again. Right. He's running 30 miles a day, 100 straight days. And I met him out in Bennett, Colorado, out in the direction where you grew up out there. And it was a hot as blazes day, and he'd just run his 30 miles. And, you know, sat and had a chat with the guy. And, of course, at the time, he was 77 years old. And talking to him was like talking to a Southern preacher. I mean, you know, he's from Southeast Kentucky or something like that. I think he was originally from Georgia. I don't know. But in any case, this guy was just like, he would just fire you up. And I mean, it was so awesome talking to this guy. And like I say, he was running across the country at the age of 77. And, you know, you look at that and say, geez, I'm hurting here. As I told you off air, my hip's hurting, my knee's hurting. And I think about, well, Stan wasn't complaining about anything. I'm sure he was hurting, but he was just as happy as could be running across the country.
Yeah, I believe he, his first time across, and I think at one time he might have held the record. I'm not sure, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but then Frank Giannino came along and, you know, beat his record. And since then, you know, it's been broken, you know, a couple of times. So, you know, he's probably third or fourth fastest, but I think that was in the 1980s. So it was quite some time ago.
Yeah, well, when he did it, he told me it was the 30th anniversary of when he'd done it. So if that was 2022, yeah, it would have been, it's probably longer ago than that. But yeah, you know, Stan always told me he was the original inspiration for Forrest Gump. So I don't know if it's true or not, but, you know, it's a great story.
Yeah. Yeah, incidentally, there was some fellow, I can't remember his name, but, you know, in that movie, Forrest Gump, they've got that, I can remember this scene where they've got this scribble of him going across the country multiple times, and I can't even remember how many times it was. It was like four or five or something like that.
Yeah.
And then he finally stopped running. There's a fellow who duplicated that and just finished doing that most recently. So he did multiple crosses. I think it's four or five.
Wow. And then he stopped in the same place Forrest Gump did?
Well, I don't know about that.
Right. I don't even know if we know where that place it was, but even so, it was, holy cow. I didn't know somebody had done that. That is amazing. I mean, I've heard a lot of stories about how running across the country, just one time can break you down. This guy's going to have to take a couple of years off his feet, I guess, right?
Yeah. I would say so.
Yeah. So I touched a little bit about your book there as, again, trying to move backwards, so to speak. Tell us a little bit more about what you are covering in your book. And I'm sorry, remind me the name again.
Okay. So the first book is Running on Empty.
Yeah. Great book. And, right.
Yeah. That came out, after I ran across, you know, of course, the U.S., and that was kind of the subject of the book where, you know, I wove some other things in. And really, it's for me, it was sort of a tribute to my wife, more of a love story than anything. It wasn't that much about running, although it chronicled, you know, going across the U.S. Plus, it's a lot of people, you know, who or a few people use it for a handbook, because in the back, it's got a glossary of, you know, calories that I ate and elevation and route. And, you know, it's just a glossary of just about everything that you know, you would need to do and need to know about running across the U.S. So that was the first one. And then the second one is called Both Feet on the Ground.
Right.
And I wrote that with the intention of it being the last book that I would write. And I wanted to say everything that I needed to say in that book and just call it quits. And I've held true to that. You know, with me, I think, that came out, I guess, 3-4 years ago. So, you know, I was in my late 60s, and, you know, I think it's just as we were discussing, I think the older you get, the more, you feel grounded, you know, keeping with the title of that. So, and other people wanted me, they read my first book and they said, you know, you didn't talk about, you know, the seven summits and climbing Everest. You didn't talk about the eco challenges. You didn't talk about the stuff you did in Death Valley, you know, including that circumnavigation and stuff like that. And why don't you tell us more about that? So I formatted it where I went into a lot more adventures, but then what I came away with, the benefit of doing that. And also it touches on something that, you know, at the very start of this, where we talked about, you know, some of the things like, you know, we've got these gadgets that, you know, we've got our iPhones, we've got this, we've got that, we've got stereo, you know, that we listen to when we run. It's about disengaging from all of that and getting out into, you know, the wilderness. And incidentally, this came out just about the time COVID started. So it's encouraging people. You know, everybody was shut up in their houses and stuff like that. And so it's encouraging people to get out. And sure enough, you know, I think a lot more people did during COVID, you know, get into sports and things like that and start going outside more. You know, I'm not quite sure of the statistics on that, but I can't say that my book, you know, contributed to that. But I think we have seen more of that.
Yeah, no, the social distancing was definitely satisfied, if you would, by getting outdoors. You know, in Colorado, I know all of a sudden the trails actually became more crowded during COVID because of that. And I remember even taking grief from people because you runners are out here and you're breathing all over the place here. And it's like, sorry.
I mean, no, right.
Yeah,
right.
We can't. Breathing's not optional. What
they didn't know is that you'd been out there for decades before.
Right, exactly.
Running those same trails.
Yep. So, but it was good. People did get out more with it and everything. But in your book, you did have to, you did go into some new areas, or, so to speak. But the whole thing about getting out into nature and, you know, getting away from the electronic devices and everything, and, you know, is huge. You know, I make a point, you know, I joke with people, you know, people will sign up to follow me on Strava, for instance. And right. I said, well, good luck, because I never have anything on Strava. I mean, I only have Strava because I do have some athletes I coach who have Strava accounts, sure. And that way I can follow them. But I said, good luck if you think you're going to follow me, because when I go for a run, generally, I don't have my phone with me. I don't listen to anything. I enjoy being out there in nature. And, you know, I'm looking forward. I'm going to take a trip to Chile in a few weeks, and we are going to be off the grid for a good portion of that. And it's you know, I'm looking forward to that part of it as well. Obviously, you know, running around Death Valley, for instance. I don't know what kind of cell phone coverage there is out there, but you're pretty much off the grid there too, I would imagine, most of the time. So I imagine that's part of the beauty of it.
Yeah, it really was. And, you know, I did that with a friend, Dave Heckman, and we were out there 16 and a half days. And we got to the point where, you know, our backpacks were only about 16, 17 pounds, and we had, you know, a sleeping pad, and we even had a little tent, which, you know, we kind of left it behind after a couple of days, and we were just essentially just sleeping in the dirt. And life became so simple. We incidentally had gone out 2 months before, and we buried over 30 caches.
Right.
And we'd do about a marathon a day, and, you know, we'd have two caches in between, one with water, and we did this in the summer, so, you know, it was absolutely necessary to do that. But it was so peaceful, and we discovered, you know, some interesting things. For example, and I go over this in my book, where, you know, long ago, you know, we were waking up in the middle of the night, and we'd kind of rummage around and stuff, and it's like, well, you know, what's up with this? And we found out what they call it is split sleep, where you know, you'll sleep for, you know, 3 or 4 hours, and then you'll get up and do things, and then you'll go back to sleep. And it's extremely restful. And, you know, some of the old timers, you know, that's where the terminology came from. So it was things like that. And it's like, where did that come from? And so we had to look up some of the things that were happening. Now, take, for instance, when we finished that run, we, of course, have been plodding along at 3-4 miles an hour or whatever for 16 days straight. And we got in a van and we hadn't had any ice. And, you know, of course, it was hot and stuff like that. And I looked over at Dave and he had an ice cube and it was almost like a phallic thing where he's sitting there savoring it, sucking on it and stuff like that. And then all of a sudden, the car takes off and we're doing maybe 20, 30 miles an hour. And I'm grabbing the dash and I'm going, oh, my God, will you slow down? It was like speed. The sense of speed had disappeared because we were going so slow. And all of a sudden we were immersed in this van where we were going, you know, and sometimes we were doing 40, 50 miles an hour and it was almost frightening.
Oh, my God. That's bizarre.
Yeah, it is bizarre.
Yeah, I mean,
your mind is so palatable.
Yeah, it reminds me of, like, you know, when they've taken a kid who was like grew up in Africa, and suddenly he gets adopted and he sees a light for the first time or something, and it's like, what the
heck? Right.
You know, I think of the story of one, what's his name? Lopez Lomong, who was one of the lost boys of the Sudan, and he got adopted, and they put him in a bedroom and say, hey, this is your bedroom here, and he slept with the light on the whole night because he didn't know that there was a light switch. He didn't even know what that was. He didn't know he could turn the light off. But you were in a situation where you'd been totally transformed into a 5 or 6 mile per hour guy for so long.
Yeah. Yeah. It was quite an experience. And, you know, just, I don't think I've ever felt so connected. You know, on Everest, I think there's too many people.
Yeah.
Not that there's a whole lot, but there's too many people. But you can feel very alone there in the desert. You know, of course, Dave was there, but I never felt alone. I always felt like a warmth and a comfort. And you could see the stars out. The sun was out, you know, warming you early in the morning and things like that. So I felt so very, very connected with nature. And I don't know if it'll ever happen again.
Right. No, that must have been amazing. And, you know, the fact you were burying caches of supplies reminds me of, you know, the old days. We didn't have these fancy packs and everything. And I would go out for a long run and literally I'd have to go drive out there ahead of time and stash bottles under, you know, under bridges or whatever. And, you know, it kind of reminded me of the same thing. And, I mean, yeah, I just think of how much time that must have taken. I mean, the run was 425 miles or something. And, I mean, you had to drive all around all that area just to lay those caches out there. What an undertaking.
Yeah, we did. And so we'd have to find, you know, obscure roads. And then we followed the perimeter of Death Valley, which you're right, it's about 425 miles. And it took us a full week because we'd have to, you know, we buried 500 gallons of water, basically. We only used 300, but we had it buried. And so we'd be out in the middle of the desert digging something that looked like a grave. And I can remember at one point we were not that far off of a road and somebody goes by and we're out there digging, right. You know, where it's dark and there's lights out there and, you know, we're digging these grave-like things and, you know, Charlie.
Who did you murder? Right. Yeah.
Charlie Manson had actually had his hideout.
That's right. Yeah.
Up there in Panama. And so, you know, people probably are thinking to themselves, oh my God, what are these guys doing out there?
Yeah. Well, they were looking real close, make sure you didn't have a swastika engraved in front of your head there.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Oh, yeah. I bet that was pretty crazy. People looking at you like, what the hell is going on out there?
Yeah. Yeah, damn. It was.
Yeah. Yeah. Obviously. And, yeah. Go ahead.
And there were times when, you know, we wouldn't even hit a road for 2 or 3 days and we were just going completely cross country. But it became sort of second nature where we could look across the plain and we could pick out vegetation and gullies and, you know, the topography, and figure out exactly what it was going to be like when we hit there. We could read the landscape very well and pick our way through without even looking at a map.
Wow. Yeah. And like you said, you weren't on a, boy, getting some weird reverb there, but you guys weren't even on a road. So, and you're covering just quick math in my head, like about 25 miles a day, which is pretty remarkable, really.
Yeah. It was good.
Yeah.
You know, it'd take us 14, 16 hours because some of it was pretty rough terrain.
Yeah. Wow. Something else. Obviously, we could talk a lot about running Badwater, Death Valley, and all that. But, you know, everybody, of course, when they talk about the seven summits, everybody wants to hear about Everest. I'll tell you the one I want to hear about, and you want to talk about kind of being out there a little bit. I am an Antarctica freak, and I want to hear about Vincent Massif. You know, I mean, obviously, that's one of the seven summits, the highest peak in Antarctica, and the most remote, of course. So I'd like to hear more about what it was like doing that one.
Yeah, so, you know, it is remote. You fly into base camp, and what they like to call that is like a mini Denali. It's about half the distance. It's, you know, takes about half as long. And I'm not so sure it's much colder. I guess it is, because it was about, there were a couple of days where it was, you know, an honest 30 below. I mean, this is not wind chill. It was 30 below, and so you had to be very careful about, you know, making sure that your nose was covered, because within, you know, 10, 15 minutes, it had turned black on you if you didn't. So you had to be careful about that. But, you know, it's 16,000 feet down there, so you're at altitude also. But Antarctica is such an extraordinary place, just because it's, you know, the depth of that, you know, ice is, you know, I think it's over a mile or something in some places. It's just incredible.
Oh, yeah. People don't realize the South Pole itself is up over 9,000 feet. And it's all, you know, just ice underneath there, basically. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, you think about that, and it's, you know, it's just fantastic. So I had, there's Vern Tejas. I don't know if you know that name, but he's an old adventure racer, plus he's a mountaineer. He was the first person to do the seven summits twice in one year. Mm-hmm. Now there's been other people who have done, you know, similar things, and he was the first person to climb Denali in the winter. So, you know, I got to know Vern, and Vern is quite an extraordinary person, and he takes his violin along with him, or his fiddle, and so they entertain you. You know, you're sitting in this sort of an igloo-like thing, and he doesn't call them hemorrhoids, he calls them Polaroids, you know, where you're sitting on your butt, listening to him. And, you know, he's an extraordinary person, because there was one gal who was really having trouble, and I can remember him walking backwards up a 40-degree slope and hand-feeding this person so she could keep her energy up, you know, some little, like, you know, candies and things like that. Quite an extraordinary person. But, you know, the wind came up on summit day, and it was bitter, bitter cold. And we were very fortunate that, you know, we had Vern, you know, taking us up. And, you know, it wasn't that difficult of a climb, but, you know, it was, you know, a reasonably long day and just super, super cold. And, you know, you take your gloves off to, you know, take your liners and try and do something. And within just 30 seconds or so, you know, you better put your glove back on, or else you get it forever to get your hand warmed back up. But what a pristine, calm place when the wind wasn't blowing. And after we had summited, I went over to what they call this peak, they call it Mount Heather, and it's almost a perfect pyramid.
Right.
And, of course, my wife's name is Heather, and I thought to myself, I'm going to go over and pick a rock off from the top of that, because, you know, there's some debris and stuff up there. And So I was able to go over there, and I was completely alone. And it was kind of frightening in a way, because there were places where you could feel the snow below you just sort of fall. Ooh. And there'd be like a woof. And I think to myself, man, I'm going to fall in a crevice and they're never going to find me again.
Nope.
But that's so incredibly quiet and peaceful that, you know, it's hard to describe. So, you know, it's very pristine. It's pretty much untouched. So, you know, Heather wants to go down there, you know, and take a trip and, you know, of course, not climb or anything, although she did climb, you know, a lot of the other peaks with me, like Kilimanjaro or, you know, in Australia, Tall Pasco and things like that. And, you know, one of the reasons I wanted a rock from there is, you know, I've got this thing about bringing rocks from the top of each mountain. So I've got a rock from the top of each one of the seven summits. Then what I did is I went to a lapidary and I had them turn stones. And I had a custom-made necklace for Heather because she had been so patient and encouraging for me.
Oh, wow.
Had one of those stones put in each one of the mountains that was custom-made, which represented each of the seven summits. So I'm sure it's, you know, it's one-of-a-kind necklace. But
yeah, that's incredible.
So I presented that to her, you know, as a gift for letting me do that and supporting me and so on.
Oh, man. I mean, you know, that comes from your fertile mind right there to even think of a lot of these things that you've done. I mean, to think of even putting something like that together, I mean, that how special. That's incredible.
Well, thanks. Yeah. She appreciated it.
Yeah, right. Well, yeah, she put up with it, so she deserved it. You're right.
Yeah, so, you know, one of the things is, you know, that, you know, I'll mention because I think it's very important is, you know, I'm out there doing all these things and people think, oh, you know, he's this kind of extreme person. He's doing all these things and, you know, wow, you know, he must be this or that, you know, so great or so strong or, you know, whatever it is. And, you know, all of the stuff that I did, I had so much support along the way. And so it's those people in the background that really helped me accomplish what I did in the past. So, you know, it's I'd be remiss if I didn't, you know, say something about that. And, you know, I'm sure you've had support. And we were talking about Dave Clark and, you know, the Superman project and things like that. So, you know, and I'm sure he realized that too. And he thrived upon having other people with him and around him and encouraging them. So it's people like him that, you know, help get people like us up the mountain or whatever.
No, of course. I mean, anybody who's done an ultra knows that your crew is absolutely essential and they sacrifice so much. And a lot of them aren't runners or maybe not even athletes who contribute. I remember a while back, you know, you mentioned Frank Giannino, I think before.
Yeah.
I remember watching the video that had been made of his Transamerica run and he had his family helping out, and these were absolutely not athletes, not runners. He mentioned a brother, I think, who rode a bike who, you know, he was getting saddle sores because, you know, the guy wasn't a bike rider. But, you know, it took all those people to help get him, you know, from one coast to the other. And, you know, of course, we know that in every race we run.
Right. Yep.
Yep. Very, very amazing. I mean, I've always been amazed when I hear about, you know, obviously Heather rode with you, you know, rode alongside, so to speak, when you did the Transamerica run. I mean, that's a huge chunk of time that somebody's taken out of their lives to be able to support people. I mean, when David, he did his bike ride from Chicago to New York. I mean, he had Ed and I'm trying to remember, there was one other guy with him too. But yeah, those guys gave up their time to just deal with this guy riding his fat tire bike across from Chicago to New York in the middle of January. So it's cool when people do that.
Yep. Yep. They're the real heroes.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, again, we mentioned kind of the creativity of creating this necklace. I've always been fascinated by the creativity to even come up with some of the ideas that people have. I mean, yeah, obviously, you know, you just mentioned somebody did the seven summits twice in a year, you know, who comes up with an idea of running the perimeter of Death Valley, or, you know, just a lot of things are pretty, you know, okay, Seven Summits, that's pretty obvious, you know, but some of these, you know, things, you know, this route or that route or, you know, whatever, like, yeah, you know, where have you come up with a lot of your inspiration to do some of the things that you've done?
You know, I think a little bit of it, I have a degree in fine arts, so, you know, I'm used to thinking artistically. And I think of running as sort of an art form in and of itself. So for me, there was a period of like 13 years where I would try and think of something or go out and do something that nobody else had done. You know, take, for instance, like people used to joke about, oh, you know, Leadville and Pikes Peak is on the same day or weekend.
Right.
You know, and they joke about, oh, you know, why don't you go out and do that? And I thought to myself, man, that's a great idea. So, you know, I went out and
you're
did
gullible
it.
As hell, man.
Sometimes it comes from other people. Other right. times, like Death Valley Circumnavigation was actually Dave's idea. And it took him 2 or 3 years just to convince me to do it. And then he wanted to do it with, you know, caches, and he wanted not caches, but, you know, like a crew. And then he wanted to do it in the winter, and I told him, the only way I'll do it with you is, you know, we have to do it in summer, we'll bury caches and, you know, so on. So it's kind of a blending of things. So, you know, we, and then there was, I did Badwater. I can't remember what I called it. It was, I don't know. Something about the Seven Summits, but I do the, you know, I think it took me 2.5 years, so I do Badwater every year as well as one of the Seven Summits. So, you know, it doesn't sound like much, but you get off Kilimanjaro and you've got a week to train for Badwater, and you've been on a mountain the whole time, or Mount Everest when it's been cold as hell, and then you get out to Badwater right. and you don't have any heat training. So, you know, that was kind of a challenge. So, you know, it's just little things like that, and just kind of thinking in your mind, you know, what's different? What wouldn't, you know, people think about? But there's so many things that people haven't done that it's, to be frank, it's very easy to come up with something. But to make it very, very unique and sort of own it, you know, I think that that motivates you to, you know, actually follow through and do it also. But I think it's a creative thing.
Yeah. I mean, David had that kind of fertile mind. I mean, you know, some of the challenges he did, it's like, you know, running 343 laps on a track to honor the number of firefighters who died in the World Trade Center. I mean, just, he would think of things like that. I mean, the American Heroes Run. I mean, the fact he came up with these distances, and, you know, one race starts when one plane hit the first tower, another one the second plane. I mean, just, it's kind of amazing how he would come up with those kind of ideas. Again, he had a fertile mind like that, which is crazy. You know, when I first heard about Badwater, years and years ago, my first thought was, well, that's a shame. They run from the lowest point in the U.S. and they don't go all the way to the top at Mount Whitney, which is the highest point. I mean, they go, you know, obviously part way up. And what, you did that.
Oh, yeah. All of my, you know, I finished the actual race 20 times, and those, all of them are to the top.
Right.
So, you know, in keeping with the original concept, who is it? Oh, who's the guy who's the race ambassador for Runner's World? I'm trying to think of his name. But he wrote a book.
Is it Ambie Burfoot?
Pardon?
Ambie Burfoot?
No, I know Andy.
Yeah, I know. Okay.
Oh, gosh, I can't think of his name. But anyhow, he wrote a book also, and he talked about how the race itself now has, I shouldn't even say this, a phony finish. So anyhow, yeah, I've always prided myself in going in, and I think I've, you know, I've got 31 crossings of Death Valley one way or another, and some are like quads, so there's only two summits, and then one was a north to south when it was still a monument. So that didn't include a summit, but I think I've done summits like 28 of them with, you know, some of the crossings that I've done. Yeah. So, you know, really the concept is to go from the lowest to the highest. And I can't imagine doing it any other way. And I always said to myself, when I'm not able to do it anymore, that's when I need to, you know, quit doing the race. So anyhow.
Yeah. No, that's awesome that you did summit on those. That's great. You had one year you pulled a cart, I remember. I'm trying to remember what that was all about.
Yeah, it was just a solo. And what I, you know, that was a challenge from one of my crew members. We were out there running the actual Badwater race. And he said to me, his name was Keith Pippin. He said, he was an engineer, and he sat down and he calculated things. And we were talking about whether or not a person could actually pull enough water to get across Death Valley and up to the top of Whitney, totally self-contained. And so he bet me that I couldn't do it. And so what I did is I grabbed a 20-gallon cooler and filled it with water and had a rickshaw-like cart.
Yeah.
And the first time I tried it, I didn't make it. So I waited about 5 or 6 years, and then I got around to doing it again, and then I was successful. So, you know, if you don't succeed, you know, try it again. But, yeah, the cart weighed 228 pounds, I think, when I started.
Holy cow.
Yeah, the first, you know, pulling it up like Towns Pass or something, it probably weighed about 190 pounds then. You know, it took me a while to get it up there.
Yeah, I was just trying to picture you training doing that, like, you know, like going around Evergreen or something, hauling this thing behind you or wherever.
Well, yeah. And that's an interesting, you know, story also. I lived in Fort Morgan, Colorado, and I built the cart, and I filled it full of water, and I thought to myself, well, you know, I'm going to see how this feels to, you know, just train with it or whatever. And so I pulled it around two city blocks, so probably about a half mile, and I threw it in my garage, and I'm never going to, you know, I'll do this again, but it's going to be in Death Valley. I'm never going to pull that cart again until I get out there because it felt almost impossible. So I thought to myself, you know, if I keep doing this, I'm going to talk myself out of it. Right. So I need to go out there and just get to the starting line and do it.
Wow.
So I didn't really train, but I was in great shape to do just about anything then.
Oh man, you must. I mean, yeah, that's obviously contrary to all training advice out there. You know, it's like,
it is.
Yeah, it's like wearing a brand new pair of shoes or something, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Oh, brilliant. Well, I'm glad it worked.
And then what was even more amazing is that, you know, some of the things that I've done, I just did them to show that people could do them, such as that. And there's a host of people that are trying, they called me up and they say, you know, I'm going to go out and try and break your record. And I said, what record are you talking about?
Right.
And they'd say, oh, you know, it's this one or that one or whatever. And, I was always amazed that people were even paying attention to it.
Right, right.
Because that's not how I did it. I just did it for the hell of it.
Yeah, well, I can just picture somebody builds their own cart. They don't know what the hell they're doing. They go out there, the wheel falls off or something, and they end up dying out there, you know, because they couldn't move. And I'm just thinking, it's all going to come back to Marsh's. It's going to be his fault because he gave him the idea to do this, right?
It could be.
Right.
Yeah. There's a disclaimer that goes along with all of the advice that I give.
Yeah.
If you don't survive, it's not my fault.
Yeah, that's true. You do need the disclaimer. I heard about a guy years ago. This woman I became acquainted with had a boyfriend who did a Transamerica run, but he was pushing some sort of cart. And there were times when I guess he could actually stand on the axle and basically like coast. You know, so you'd get over the Rocky Mountains, I guess, and like coast down, you know, the Front Range. And I thought, well, that sounds like cheating to me. I don't know. It just, I mean, yeah, he pushed it up the mountain, but then the fact that he rode down the other side, and he did run across the whole country, I guess, with this thing. But I thought, that doesn't sound right to me. I don't know.
Yeah, that's, his name's Glenn Turner.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and so Glenn introduced me to Giannis Kuros.
Oh, wow.
In Boulder.
Yeah.
And I had a conversation with Giannis Kuros. And, people consider him sort of the top of the heap anyhow still,
right.
Even though some of his records have begun to get broken, you know, such as a 48 hour and stuff like that. But he was such an extraordinary athlete. But one of the things I wanted to ask him is, one time when I was running out in Death Valley, I literally had an out of body experience where I was flying above myself, watching myself run. And I didn't tell anybody about it for a half dozen years. And then I saw him and I said, if there's anybody that I can talk to this, you know, about, it's you. And so I asked him about that. And you know what his reply was? He says, "Oh, that happens all the time to me." And I said, well, how the hell do you get there? Because I've never been able to experience it, but it was such a peaceful feeling, because for 6 or 8 hours I ran and it was like so effortless, and I was watching myself run. And he said, you've got to go out there and just beat yourself down to where there's nothing left, and then you'll, you know, kick into that next sort of ethereal phase or whatever you want to call it. And so sure enough, I went back and I was looking at his 24-hour 48, and all of a sudden, after about, you know, maybe a dozen or 18 hours, or you saw that his performance increased. And he says, that's where it happened to me. That's where it would happen to me.
Wow.
It was so weird. And I've never been able to, you know, attain that again.
Right.
But
right.
He said, oh, yeah, happens all the time.
You know, it reminds me, boy, I've got reverb is pretty bad for a sec there. David would talk about, you know, rising like a phoenix sometimes in races.
Yeah.
And, you know, I still remember when he was running Leadville, I'm trying to remember if he'd just done Hard Rock or he'd done Badwater, one of those. And he was a mess. I mean, he was right at the cutoff at Twin Lakes. And I told him at the time, I said, you got to get out of that chair because it's growing arms around you right now. And he got up and he just flew after that. And long story short, he ended up, you know, coming in ahead of the cutoff by, I don't know, 4 or 5 hours, which that's an amazing rally there. And he always said, well, you know how that happens? Like, you're really feeling down and all of a sudden it kind of comes back to you. And I'm like, no. I don't. It doesn't happen to me. But you hear that with a lot of people, though. You know, Giannis is obviously talking about, well, you know, it had to do with his hallucinating or whatever. But how many times have you had things like that happen where, like, you know, things just look really grim and then, you know, you somehow found another level to pull you out of it?
Yeah, with running, you know, it's kind of, you know, it can happen. And I'm sure, you know, you probably had this happen too, 2 or 3 times during a 100-mile race or even more, where you have a high, and then all of a sudden you're in the dumps.
Oh, yeah.
And you kind of, you know, rise up and, you know, do very well. I think with the Eco Challenge, we experienced it a lot because those were long, you know, multi-days, sometimes as much as 10 and 12 days.
Right.
And, we'd always have crew members, or not crew members, but I mean members of the team. There were either 4 or 5 people. And usually it was just one person that would go down. And then the others would just pick them up, take their pack, you know. And so sure enough, they'd always come back for the most part anyhow. And then if you had 2 people that were down, it made it a little bit more dicey. But we never had more than 2 people that would go down at one time.
That's good.
Keep moving.
Yeah.
And, you know, it'd just be a little bit slower. And everybody else would kind of pick up the pieces and, you know, help the other person along. And sure enough, they come back. And then it might be you that's the next person that goes down. And, you know, it's just a matter of time. And, you know, other people would pay attention and make sure that you were drinking enough or eating enough or, you know, whatever, and bring it back from, you know, bring it back to life, basically.
Yeah. Well, that's the definition of teamwork right there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And hopefully your friends like you enough not to leave you out there in the desert.
Yeah. And we saw a lot of that too with the Eco Challenges, where, you know, you'd see these teams that were just out there at each other's throats. And those were the stories that they liked to focus on. And so, you know, we never really got any camera coverage for those first Eco Challenges. Of course, in 2019, we did because of Mark. But we were way too boring because we got along so well.
Right, right.
So we weren't worth covering.
No, I know. It's kind of like I joked before about how nobody cares about my story going through surgeries and having all these comebacks. You know, if it's alcoholism or obesity, you said that's more exciting. You know, that was the edge David had over me.
Yeah.
No, but yeah, you're right. You guys weren't newsworthy there, so to speak.
No.
Darn it. Yeah, you should have... Yeah, you should have just left somebody hanging in a tree or something and, you know, like let somebody else find the body there. And yep.
Yeah.
Oh, well. So what's motivating you now? What kind of challenges are you looking forward to at this point?
Well, you know, I'm, you know, like yourself, we had talked a little bit before this, you know, we're dealing with some medical issues, and one of the doctors, was telling me, "Well, where do you want to be? I mean, you can limit your activity and get along with this." And I said, "No, you don't understand. I want to be back to where I was before all this happened."
Oh yeah.
So, you know, if you have to do some sort of a surgery or something, you know, my goal is to get back at least to where I was, or you know, approximately. So. You know, I think what motivates me now is just looking forward to getting back, getting healthy and doing, you know, what I love to do. I do it a lot slower at a snail's pace or whatever. But, you know, I love just being out there. And it doesn't matter how long it is. I think as we get older, it's like time is not of the essence anymore. You know, I don't have to be out there winning a race or something. But, you know, I just have to be out there. And that's what makes me, you know, keeps me sane. So that's my goal. And the motivation is, you know, it's another challenge to overcome.
Right. No. And, you know, the thing is people can find those challenges in a lot of different ways. I mean, I've done some people know, I've done a lot of pretty, interesting travel here in the last few years. And I look at traveling as a challenge even. I mean, you know, trying to navigate everything you have to go through half the time. But even when you're there dealing with different cultures, different languages, different food, everything else, I enjoy that. That's, you know, if people ask me, why am I traveling? I mean, I'm doing it, while I can, you know, and I can go to places like Tokyo and go for a long run and enjoy the city and all. But it's a challenge getting through all the hurdles you have to just to getting over there, you know? So
it is.
Yeah.
You know, we always looked at it as kind of the crappy part of racing, and the racing was the reward.
Right.
You know, the carrot that we looked for. But it was a pain getting, you know, all that gear, bikes and, you know, paddles and whatever, you know, to the other end, especially with, you know, with, of course, the adventure racing. But boy, when we got there and got out, you know, in the jungles or something, it would usually take us, we always figured 2 or 3 days to sort of settle in and adjust to, you know, what we were doing. You know, it was kind of uncomfortable or whatever. And after 5 or 6 or 7 days, it became just a way of life for us. And then we'd get to the point where we didn't want to go home. We just wanted to stay out there. We loved it so much.
Well, yeah, it took so much effort just to get yourself in that homeostasis, so to speak, where, you know, you're able to do that every day. It's like, oh, shoot, now we're done with it. Okay. I totally relate to that. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of organizing and everything going in, and once you get the ball rolling, that's when the fun begins.
Yeah, exactly.
I have a goal. I want to run the New York City Marathon when I'm 90. That's one I've had out there for a while. I mean, obviously the first object is I got to live that long, you know, so there's no guarantee of that. But, go back to my hometown and go run the marathon, I think would be great.
Yeah, we need those long-term goals.
Yeah, absolutely. So a lot of little things in between, but, got to get the body working and get the oil and the lube done and, the minor repairs, major repairs, the whole works, right?
Yeah. Yep. Exactly.
Yeah. So, you're continuing work with Alzheimer's and with Mace and everything. I mean, Mace is just amazing. I mean, he's donated a kidney, I know. You know, his wife has had her health challenges. I mean, but they're so resolute. I think as we age and we go through all these challenges, I mean, I think attitude comes down to everything. I mean, I hate nothing worse than people who... You know, like, oh, I don't like to run in the morning because I'm not a morning person. You know, it's like, you can make yourself a morning person. You don't have to always be like, you know, it's, and that's what I think is amazing about people like Mace. It's like, it doesn't matter. I mean, this is the worst adversity you can have, and he's never let down.
Yeah. And it's interesting about Mace because he was the first in the family really to go out and do Leadville. and you know, Iron Man, things like that, but Leadville in particular, ultra running. So it spilled over to, you know, his Pam, his wife's brother, and that's Eric Pence, who has done now 27 Leadvilles.
Right.
27 or 28, I don't know what it is. So there's Eric, and then there's his brother-in-law who went out and did it. And then there's somebody else in his family. Well, of course, Travis.
Of course.
You know, so I mean... It's almost like a family tree, only it's a family tree of running.
Right.
And Mace was the base. He was the one who motivated everybody to go out there and do that. So I guess, long story shorter, people pay attention to what you're doing, especially when it's extraordinary things like what Mark did, what Dave Clark did. People pay attention to that. They're motivated by that. So, you know, don't fool yourself that, you know, you're not doing it, or you're going out there and doing it for yourself. You're doing it for others too. They pay attention.
Right. No, without a doubt. I mean, the impact David has had, and I say has had as you know, almost present tense, it's amazing because, again, as soon as he passed away, so many people reaching out with messages about how much he meant to them, even though they'd never even met him personally. And as I mentioned, I can't remember if I mentioned this off air or on air, that when I got on his Facebook page this morning, just to pick a picture off of there, there were already 58 people who had wished him a happy birthday today. It's just, and it was like at 9 a.m. It's like, holy cow, that's incredible. The ripple he's had out there that keeps you know, spreading out, as you know, ripples in a lake do if you drop a stone in.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So what haven't we touched on here? I mean, obviously we could talk about an awful lot of things, but what other things should we delve into here?
Well, you know, I, you know, it's like I was telling my wife, you know, podcasts are, you know, they're interesting and stuff, but it seems like, you know, such as yourself, I can talk, it's, you know, I can talk about things, you know, sort of flip back into, you know, meeting this person or that person and how they motivated me. But, you know, I think for the most part, you know, I don't think a lot of what I've done is extraordinary at all. And so, sometimes, you know, I can talk about it and it's entertaining and stuff like that. But it's just like you were saying at the start, when you went out and first ran Leadville for the first time, it was kind of for a pure reason, just because you wanted to go out and do it.
Yeah.
And it was as simple as that. So, you know, I think more than anything, if we can just kind of hold that thought and, you know, go after our goals with not expecting, you know, a lot of kudos from other people or whatever, but just, you know, doing it for the right reasons, fundraising, whatever it is.
Right.
You know, I think, you know, and we've kind of gone over that too. So, you know, it's life is a journey. That's for sure.
Yeah. And it is funny because, you know, obviously you've had your reasons for doing a lot of these races and, you know, you started from Fort Morgan, Colorado, which for people who don't know, is out in the northeastern plains of the state, a very, you know, small farming community and agricultural. And, you know, you went out there to do these things and then people come back, go, wow, Marshall, you're incredible and everything. And, you know, I'm sure it probably shakes you a little bit, like, oh, that's kind of weird. Why do people think of it that way? Because I'm just doing what I'm enjoying doing, right?
Yeah. You know, it's true. It's a, you know, I think we all do extraordinary things in our lives, you know, just raising a family, just, you know, raising, you know, wonderful, productive kids or having a great relationship or something. There's, you know, that's extraordinary in and of itself. You know, this is just sort of a side note or whatever. It's just, I don't want to call it a hobby because, you know, it does get pretty intense at times, the training and all that, and consumes a lot of our life. But, you know, everybody is doing something special and can achieve just extraordinary things in their lives. And they do. And absolutely, they don't even think about it.
Yeah, no, you know, I always think about how sports translates to other parts of our lives. And certainly a challenge doesn't have to be an athletic one, much less a running one. I mean, it could be starting a business, could be writing a book, it could be, you know, whatever things that you feared before that, you know, you have to sometimes just take that leap. And that's just as extraordinary, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, you mentioned writing a book. You know, when I got out of high school, you know, the counselor said, well, I don't know what to tell you, because usually they put you into counseling, you know, to go to college or something like that. And they said, well, you're just not made for college, and, you know, look for some sort of a technical trade or something like that. And I thought to myself, oh, come on, man. So anyhow, I graduated from college, of course, and then you know, I wrote a book, even though, you know, my grade point average was probably 1.9. It was less than like a C minus average graduating from high school. But, you know, it's, you know, that was even more of a challenge for me to write a couple of books than, you know, go out there and go around Death Valley.
Right.
So, yeah.
Oh, great counselor there. I love that. Like, you know, we spent 12 years on you, and we just don't even know what the heck to do with you at this point.
Yeah, exactly. That's what they said.
Yeah.
You're a lost cause.
Right. Really nice. You know,
and it pissed me off.
Sure.
It pissed me off. It's like, yeah, well, I'll show you.
Yeah, well, exactly. That's the first thing that's going to put a burr in your saddle. The first time somebody tells you, like, you know, you always hear stories about, well, somebody believed in me. Well, the first time somebody says they don't believe in you, it's almost as much of a motivator, right?
There you go.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, I've only been to one of my high school reunions, and, you know, it was a very high number. Well, I'll just leave it that way. And it was always amazing to me how the kids who were the biggest screw-ups in high school seemed to be Wall Street brokers and Park Avenue lawyers, and the guy who was voted most likely to succeed is a bum somewhere, you know. Not a bum, but, you know, it's it's always funny how that works out. So that guy with that 1.9 GPA, you never know. He might he might be the next Einstein.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. Well, where can people find you out there, Marsh? I mean, you know, we talked about how we're not the best in social media here and everything, but where can people find out, you know, more about your books and what things you're doing, Route 66, all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, so Route 66, it's just Route66Ultra.com. So if you Google Route 66 and running, it'll come up. So it's the Route 66 Ultra. And then, you know, my regular website is just MarshallUlrich.com. Okay. So it's very simple. It's just myname.com.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can buy books there. You can get them on Amazon. There's both books are audio. They're Kindle versions, you know, or, you know, printed versions, hard copy, soft copy. You can learn way more than you want to know about me.
Did you do the audiobook yourself, by the way?
I did not, but you know, my first book, I sold it through Penguin Publishing, and they hired somebody to do it, and I hired the same person to do the audio. And you know, some people said, oh, you should have done it yourself, and I often wonder, but he did a great job. So he makes it very entertaining. You can tell he's a professional.
Well, it's great you were able to get James Earl Jones to voice your story, right?
Yeah, not quite, but yeah.
Yeah, that would be cool. But okay, well, great. People find you out there. One thing I will caution, though, is when I don't forget how long ago I looked up your Route 66 run. There is a Route 66 marathon in Tulsa, so just so people know to make sure they get to the right one there in Arizona.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Route 66 Ultra.
Yeah, yeah. We'll expand that just a little bit. I think next year we will do a marathon also. It just, on the route, it figures out to 26 miles to the Grand Canyon Caverns from Seligman. So we're going to be expanding that over the next years to shorter distances.
Right. Oh, I see you got a critter sneaking in there in the
side. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's Razzie, my dog. She's 13 years old.
Oh, nice. Yeah, haven't had a cat walk through here in this one.
I saw him, you know, go across there.
Oh, did they? Okay. I missed it. All right. Well, that's good. Well, I hope to make it down to that Route 66 run one time here. I love the concept. I would have come down there this year, except two things. One, I was broken, and two, I was in Asia. So that worked against it. But I would love to come down there and do that. It looks so much fun. That looks incredible.
Yeah, we'd love to have you.
Yeah, thanks. And if you next time you make it up here, we'll go do a really slow run together. How's that?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah. Are you doing the snowbird thing? Are you like half and half of the year or something? Or
Yeah, we've had quite a few things going on. I'm kind of clearing my businesses out. Turning a new chapter and turning some of those into what they call a 1031 exchange and stuff, so I have other properties. So we've been dealing with that, but we spend a lot of time down here, and we'll probably spend more, and that's in Lake Havasu, Arizona.
Okay.
So, we split our time for the most part. We spend more time up in Colorado, though.
Good. Okay. Well, great. Well, Marsh, it's been a great pleasure catching up with you here again, and love chatting with you here about all the great things you've done, things you're working on. Keep it up, man. It's always a pleasure.
Okay, and you too. Thanks very much for having me.
Absolutely. Thanks, bro.
Okay. Take care.
What a treat it always is talking with Marsh. And you can find both of his books on Amazon as well as on MarshallUlrich.com. That's Marshall with two L's, Ulrich with one L. Altogether, MarshallUlrich.com. I hope he revved up your creative juices to tackle your own epic adventures. I'm headed out myself for a high altitude one in just a couple of weeks, as long as my body cooperates. And again, drop me a message at silly_billy@msn.com or on Facebook or Instagram messengers if you might be interested in being one of the inaugural 10 individuals in the Be Positive Runners community. Thank you to Marsh, and thanks again to all of you. Can't express my appreciation enough to all of you for listening to the We Are Superman podcast. And please make sure that you subscribe so you can load all new episodes onto your phone. And if you enjoy the podcast, the best thing you can do is share it with your friends or on social media. And please do me a favor, if you have a chance, take 60 seconds and give us a 5-star rating on whatever platform on which you listen to us. And I'd also be humbly honored if you would write a review as well. These 5-star ratings and reviews really do help us make more episodes as we rise higher in the podcast services search algorithms, which helps more people find our show and inspiring stories like these. Until next time, always be positive.